Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, what's going on, man?
Hey, just plowed along through the summertime.
In the scorching heat.
A little bit of the summertime down here in South Texas, but otherwise we're good.
All right.
Are you looking forward to San Diego?
Okay. Let me just, now that you brought it up, let me just say.
You're going to plug that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. San Diego, October 19th to 21, Here We Still Stand Conference. You should probably come to that if you haven't already signed up. Here's the deal. If you want to sign up for that and you want to get 10% off your ticket because you're a podcast listener, you just go over and register, and then at the checkout, you can enter the code 40OT, all caps. So the number 4, the number 0, capital O, capital T, and that'll get you 10% off your ticket. So just for listening to this podcast. So you should probably What a deal. 10% off that thing. So go over there. I'm gonna end up down there in San Diego. Chad's gonna be there, whole bunch of other people. You can go over to herewestillstand.org, check it out, see everything that's going on there. But it's gonna be a good time, and I'd hate for you to miss it. And here's the other thing, if you're thinking like, oh yeah, I'm going, and you haven't jumped on that, we are over halfway sold out. So this isn't, there's not unlimited seating there. And we are we're a little over 50%. We're about 55% full, and we're still about 4 months out. So I'm not guaranteeing that it's going to sell out, but I'm just saying that if you want to go, there's reason to go ahead and jump on that ticket before, I don't know, the week before, because it is possible that there won't be any left, because we are halfway there, halfway to what we can hold.
Hey, good deal. Yeah, I hope as many of you as can will join us. Look forward to meeting a lot of you face to face. It'll be a good few days.
And we're going to be podcasting live from there.
That's what I hear.
That's it. Yeah. So if you want to come sit in on a live recording, studio audience of 40 minutes. Also, Thinking Fellow is going to do that. Front Porch with the Fitzes is going to do that. And Virtue in the Wasteland is going to do that. So you can sit and listen to a couple of your podcasts that you like and interact with them. So that's going to be fun. That's going to be going on Thursday afternoon before the conference actually fires up on Thursday night. So lots of reasons to come. And the food, the music, the speaking, the whole thing. I mean, the weather. There's really not any reason not to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Good deal. All right. So from San Diego to Sinai, I guess that's where we're going to go next.
Yeah,
right?
Man. I think we got a bunch of laws that are not as well known as the 10 that we went over the last couple of weeks.
No, these are not nearly as well known. It's part of chapters 21 through 23 of Exodus. I mentioned last time it's called the Book of the Covenant. That's the traditional name for this section. And it takes at least a few of the commandments and applies them to various situations that the Israelites are going to face. It's not anywhere close to any kind of complete law code, legal code, because there's all kinds of situations which are not addressed. So a lot of these are just kind of episodic things that might occur that the Israelites are going to have at least some of these laws in stone, as it were, in order to address how to deal with them. So we're going to move pretty quickly, actually. Going to summarize some of these sections and focus for a few minutes on some details, a couple of examples that are given to us, just kind of give us the flavor for what these are like. But if you want to read them on your own, hey, open up your Bible, Exodus 21 to 23. They're all there. You can check them out. Last time we began with the discussion of the relationship between the servant or the slave and the master. We talked about a few situations there. And what we're going to do now is shift to the next main section, which is going to begin at verse 12 and carry us through to the next several verses. Most of these deal with some kind of bodily assault, I guess would be the way that we could phrase this. Either either premeditated, so you actually mean to hurt somebody or even kill them, to just accidental things that happen. And it has the situations laid out for us, and then it has the penalty that is going to arise from these. And that penalty could be the death penalty, be some sort of monetary restitution that has to be made in some cases. Let me just give you a couple examples here. So this is the way it starts out. This is Exodus 21, 12. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. All right, so that's pretty straightforward. I mean, if somebody's lying in wait for somebody, they're out to kill them, and they succeed in that. In other words, if they break the fifth commandment, if they murder, then it's going to be life for life. So the death penalty will be exacted upon that person who took another person's life. That's pretty straightforward. But then the very next verse says, well, situations can occur where an accident happens. And that's what this is. It says, but if he did not lie in wait for him, so this wasn't premeditated. And he wasn't waiting in a dark alley to pull this guy in and slit his throat or something. It was an accident, whatever happened. It says, but God let him fall into his hand. That is to say that in the divine providence, this happened. God let this happen. Then he says, I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. This is talking about something we're gonna see later on in the Torah. So this was a time when a lot of the justice took place within the family. So if somebody kills my brother, then I go after him. I become kind of the judge, jury, and executioner. This is pretty common back in this world. And so what the Israelites did, or what God did for the Israelites later on, is he set up these what we might call sanctuary cities today. This is totally different though. These sanctuary cities were places of refuge, cities of refuge, to which a person who was guilty of an accidental killing, and he accidentally killed someone, it was not premeditated, they could flee to this city for refuge should the person out to avenge their relative's death come after them. So that's what it's talking about here, about appointing a city to which he may flee. But notice that there's no penalty exacted upon him. This is an accident, and so there is no penalty attached to that. There's just this reality of the need for him to have some place where he's safe should someone come after him. So that gives you one example. This section goes on to talk about their father or their mother, then they're to be put to death. Same with kidnapping in verse 16. If someone kidnaps someone or curses his father or mother, so these are, I guess, physical attacks as well as verbal attacks. Now here's one that here's an example in this section that I think is worthy of reflecting on for a minute. This is verses 18 and 19. What if two men have a quarrel? So these two guys get into a fight for whatever reason, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, but the guy doesn't die. He has to stay in bed until he gets better. And he gets up and he walks around outside on his staff. Okay. Fight between two guys, and one of them picks up a rock or he hits him with his fist, and this guy's hurt for a while, but he's not killed. He's able to get up and get around. Then it says, the one who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time. So the guy couldn't work, for instance, let's say. And so he has to make up for that. And notice this. This is the part that I think is most interesting. And he shall take care of him, completely healed. Now, in some ways, that is more of an impediment to hurting somebody than anybody else, because nobody wants to get in a fight with somebody, beat the guy up, and then be forced to nurse him back to health. I mean, that might be the worst punishment that you could inflict upon this other guy. I don't know about you, but if I were getting to a fight, the last thing I want to do is sit by this guy's bed and take care of him until he gets better.
Yeah,
That's the law.
God is familiar with the hearts of men. He's like, I got a law for you right here that you will.
Yeah.
You're like, can I just pay to like have the, I'll just pay for the doctor, I guess. No. You're gonna be the doctor.
Right. Yeah. He needs his bedpan changed. That's what you need to do. He needs his bandages taken care of. That's what you're going to do. So you shall take care of it until he is completely healed. I mean, it's almost comical to think about how this actually would have been carried out in the life of Israel. So I mean that's one example here of these laws. There's another one I think is worthy of comment before we move on to the next section. And that is from verse 20, 22 and the following verse. So these two guys get into a fight over something, all right? And strike a woman with child. All right, so these two guys get into a fight. There happens to be a pregnant woman. She's like right there. And they accidentally, this is not on purpose, but this is they accidentally hit her. I mean, you can see this happening in a group of people. So that now I'm reading my translation, so that she has a miscarriage. Literally in the Hebrew, it says, so that her children come out. It could be child, it could be children. Then yet there is no further injury. That is to say, there's no further injury to the child or children if there's twins or to the mother. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judge has decided. Okay, so two guys get into a fight. A pregnant woman standing nearby accidentally gets hurt in this struggle, and she goes into labor, and she has her children, her child. But if the baby's okay, if the mom is okay, any other penalty demanded except whatever the husband might ask. Verse 23, but if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. I think this is interesting is because it takes into account not only any harm inflicted upon the mother, but also any harm that might befall the child who is prematurely born as a result of this fight between these two guys. We saw earlier there was concern for the servant or the slave. There's a concern here for a woman as well as her unborn child. So these laws are covering all of humanity. It doesn't matter where you fall on that spectrum, slave or free, male or female, born or unborn.
Yeah, there is a thing where God is definitely concerned about the well-being of the vulnerable. So you have loads and loads of laws about have to do with slavery and servants. So people that have masters or have people over them, God puts a bunch of laws in place to make sure that they're treated well and that they're not abused and hurt. Likewise, you have in the case of the unborn, you don't get much more vulnerable than that. God puts laws in place where, hey, since you guys are prone to scrapping, you need to be careful because if this happens, it's not going to be good. You're not going to be able to write that off as like, well, just a baby. No. He is about protecting. I think that God, and maybe get a little controversial here, depending on your position on certain things. But I think that the reason, one, that God so takes care of the unborn child in this passage and in other passages as well, is because that's the place of the incarnation. And I think that the reason, and I don't mind saying this, I think the reason the devil hates unborn children is because it's the image of God in the place of the incarnation. I think the reason that's attacked, that is thought to be, he is all about devaluing that life in that place, has everything to do with the incarnation. He hates the image of God, and he hates the place of the incarnation because that's his end. And so I think you see like this struggle, as it were, between God protecting the image of God in that place, and the devil wanting to destroy or minimize the image of God in that place.
Yeah, that's a great point. When Mary is visited by the angel and is pregnant with and is pregnant thereafter with Jesus, and she goes to visit her relative Elizabeth, of course, when hears the voice of Mary greeting her, John the Baptist leaps in her womb. And there you have a great example of the presence of God born within the womb of Mary, causing a reaction in not so much Elizabeth, but in another unborn child, in John the Baptist. I mean, it's a great testimony to the fact that already within the womb of Mary, God is incarnate. He is there as a flesh and blood unborn baby, and he's already, as it were, causing reactions in the world. And he has, as he continued to do throughout his life and ministry, as John the Baptist to leap within the womb. So I agree with you. That Satan has toward Christ in his incarnation is still directed toward those who bear that image and likeness of Christ even in the womb.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, it's and this isn't a discussion about abortion or anything, but it does tell you theologically, anyway, what's going on. It's not as simple as, is it a life or isn't it a life? There's more theologically. There's more going on there. I mean, the womb theologically is huge. It's what God used to bring himself into this world. It's just the vehicle he used initially to put salvation into motion. And yeah, the devil ain't into it.
Well, he's always going against the vulnerable, and the devil is, and he's also like us to take advantage of the vulnerable, and that happens all the time, and that's the reason we have laws such as this in order to prohibit that from happening. Spread God's deep and jealous concern for those who live in a state of vulnerability, whether they're unborn children or aliens or whoever they might be, who don't have power, who don't have prestige, who don't have means of self-protection, who are open to any kind of attacks or abuse or misuse by those who are in positions of power and authority.
That's right.
All right, so the rest of the section deals with a few other concerns about injury. That most of it actually is about if there's any kind of injury that is from some kind of beast of the field, like an ox, that is prone to injuring people, and what needs to be done about that. So, and if any of you are ranchers and you have a violent ox, then you might find verses 26 through 32 interesting. I'll leave that to you to take a look at. Or if you're in the habit of digging pits and leaving them open, you might want to read verses 33 through 36, because that deals with that.
Oh man,
So
that's my go-to. I'm always digging those pits.
I thought you were. It's in Dan right here to Exodus 21. Meditate on a chapter. All right, so chapter 22, moving on here with the Book of the Covenant. This next section deals with primarily with theft and with other matters related to money. So it starts out here with say you got a thief, who animal thief. He steals an ox, or he steals some sheep from your fold, and then he slaughters the ox, or he sells the sheep. Well, if he gets caught, he's going to pay. If he stole one ox, he's got to pay five oxen. If he stole a sheep, then he has to pay four sheep to replace the one that he stole and then slaughtered or sold off. And we have another scenario. Okay, say you got say you're home, and it's the middle of the night. It's dark outside, and a thief is trying to break into your home, and you strike him with something, with your sword or with a bat or whatever it is you use to defend yourself, so that he dies. That is the thief. Blood guiltiness on his account. That is to say, the owner of the home will not be held accountable. And the presumption of this is that if you got a guy that is trying to break into your house in the middle of the night, he probably has not only the intent to steal, but also to kill you, because he's using the cover of the night to do this. That's the way this verse is usually explained. And so if there's some kind of, if the owner of the house defends himself, strikes this guy down, then it's basically what we would call self-defense. All right. But this is interesting. Verse 3 says, goes on to say, but if the sun has risen on him, so it's daytime, then there will be blood guiltiness on his account. Now, this is pretty fascinating. So if a guy breaks into the middle of the night and you kill him in self-defense, but if it's daylight and this happens, then you're not. You're going to be held accountable. And the way this is usually explained is because, like I said, if it's at night, then he's probably has more nefarious, not just to steal, but also to kill. But if the sun is risen, he's just breaking in to steal something, and so you can't defense excuse in this case.
That is bizarre.
It is bizarre. I think this is one of those great examples of, like, if we were there, we'd be like raising our hands and say, Moses, hey Moses, well. But what if this happens? You know, what if he's actually, it's daytime, but he's breaking in to actually hurt us? Then what are we supposed to do? I mean, this is only one of a multitude of laws and rules where we wish we had more. We wish we could, you know, list extenuating circumstances or, you know, other kinds of scenarios that might in some way connect with this law and say, well, what about in this case? But we don't have that. All we have are these kind of blanket statements. And we would assuming this, that in many of these situations, that's why you had judges. I mean, that's why we have judges today, because, I mean, the law does need interpretation and enforcement. And so Israel had judges in order to make these same kinds of decisions in cases that were brought to them.
Yeah, it seems like the motivation behind this distinction. So you can kind of get lost in the lack of details and lost in the hypotheticals, but it seems that the heart behind it is that if somebody is trying to kill you, you will not be held accountable if you strike them down and stop them, or if they're trying to kill, you know, your family or something like that. But what you're not allowed to do is you are not allowed to kill someone in defense of your property. And I think that this then speaks to the value that God places on life over stuff, you know? So I don't know. And here in the West, there's probably a lot of people who be like, man, you try to take my stuff, I'll kill you. But I mean, it's not how God sees it, really. He doesn't think your property is worth the life of even a thief. That's not a one for one, and so he's using night and day as some kind of way to distinguish between these two things. If this guy was sneaking in your house to steal food, God doesn't think that you have the right to kill him for it. But if he's coming in to kill you and he ends up dead, and as you are defending your family, well then you're not going to be held accountable for that. So I do think that there's something to take away from that. That is, even the life of the unrighteous thief is more valuable than your stuff.
I couldn't put it any better. That was perfect. Yeah, that's exactly right. That is the concern of that's a concern that actually permeates a lot of the Book of the Covenant, is the ultimate value that is placed upon human life. That's where you have the death penalty, like in that verse that we read earlier. Someone takes another's life with malicious intent, then his life shall be taken. But there is no death penalty here for sheep or oxen or grain or anything else. Instead, there's to be restitution. There is punishment, of course, there's to be restitution and a doubling or tripling, quadrupling of that which was stolen. But even, as you say, even the life of the thief is worth more than anyone else's stuff. So even in these laws, there's mercy that is shown to the lawbreaker. There's mercy that's shown through to the thief.
Well, I think that's an important component of the law, is not just the, hey, here's the punishment that I mean, certainly that's there, where if you do this, this is what is going to happen. But you know, when you look at, you know, like the famous eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that's not as much, and I don't think these laws are as much about demanding this amount of restitution or this amount of punishment, but it's also telling you, is putting limits on how far you can go. So an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth doesn't mean you have to go take a tooth for a tooth. It means you can't go take more. You can't go take his head. That's what it's doing. I mean, and that's what these laws are do this as well, where they're saying, look, you can't just say, well, you did this, now I get to do whatever I want to you. There's limits to how far you can go, because left on our own, we'll ascribe value to things that we shouldn't. We will punish further than we should. The laws of God work both ways. They definitely serve as a deterrent, because you don't want some of the stuff to be carried out on you. But they also serve as a restraint for how far somebody can go with the punishment that they demand.
Yeah, great points. You know, that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth section that you referenced, that's basically kind of a legal shorthand for saying, look, the punishment needs to fit the crime. The right. Punishment can't exceed the crime. I mean, so that, you're right. It's not to be interpreted literally. Eye, then your eye is going to be taken. If you take a tooth, then your tooth is going to be taken. It is simply the legal shorthand for saying, look, whatever crime is committed, the punishment needs to fit that. It can't exceed that. You can't execute someone because he hit you, because he punched you in the face. There are limits to the punishments. And the reason we know that, for instance, just looking back in that section that where the eye for eye, tooth for tooth is quoted, which was in the previous chapter, after that is stated, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, so on and so forth, we have this verse. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, so the master gets mad and he punches his slave and ends up blinding him, then it says, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, then the master's eye shall be cut out of his face. He lets his servant go free. So there is no literal eye for an eye here. That is to say that the punishment fits the crime. He should not have struck his servant. He should have struck him so hard that he ended up blinding him in one eye. And the punishment inflicted upon the master is the freedom of his servant.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, punishment fits the crime, in other words. All right, so back to 22. The rest of this section deals with matters I'll let you read on your own. It covers matters such as if you catch a thief, if there's a breach of trust, if you borrow something and don't return it, all kinds of situations that probably happen on a pretty regular basis in the life of Israel. And these are the ways in which those were to be addressed. This is a great example of Paul, the non-utopian view of life in Israel. I mean, there's nothing in this section that assumes this is going to be some sort of utopian society in Israel where everything was great and everybody loved each other and everybody got along and kind of this hippie Israel. No, I mean, there's going to be a lot of problems. You're going to have people who steal, fight. So you're going to have pregnant women who get hit in the midst of these brawls and end up going into early labor. So very realistic understanding of Israel as a community of sinners. There's going to be problems. And These laws are designed to address those in a realistic, judicial, fair sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to remember that all of this is like on the heels of the Ten Commandments. I mean, the Ten Commandments are like hot off the press, and God gives these laws are given with the assumption that the ultimate law is not going to be kept. Like
Exactly.
God already knows this is the case, which tells you something about the law. In other words, just having the law doesn't make you keep the law. God knows that. God did not endow the law with the power to cause people to keep it. That's not what the law does. In fact, he gives a law and he's like, so here's the law. And not if, but when people break it, here's how you're going to deal with it. But it's not as though he's like, here's the law, I guess we're good to go. I mean, like that's the assumption so many Christians have. I mean, it's just, post the Ten Commandments in the living room and the family will run smooth. And it's like, that's not how that
Wait,
works.
that won't work?
That will not work.
Oh man, no wonder I've been having so many problems.
Build a huge statue of the Ten Commandments, put them on the city square, and the community will run well. And it's just not the case, man. It's not how that works.
Well, wait, if you believe what Paul says, it might make matters worse. I mean, the law aggravates sin, right?
Yeah, it's like it's
Period.
almost like God knows that. He gives the law, and he's like, "Here's how you're gonna deal with all this sin that this is gonna bring about."
We've all experienced this, we're told not to do something that we never really thought about doing, and then all of a sudden we have a desire to do
I mean, if I'm like, this is how
it's just the way it works.
the law totally works like that. If you're a thief and you're reading all this, you're like, "Well, that settles it. I'm stealing stuff in the daytime."
I'm gonna become a daytime thief. Hey, they can't kill me.
That's
Yeah,
how
that's the way that's the way the sinner's mindset works, right?
totally.
The
Yeah.
more we are forbidden, the more we desire to do something. The more we're told to do something, the more that we rebel against it. That's the old Adam at work right there. All right, so we got a few minutes left. I think we can wrap up chapter 22, is 16 through 31, which are conclude this section. Are full of what in legal terms are called apodictic laws. Most of what we've been covering are case laws or casuistic laws, deal with kind of, if such and such happens, then such and such is going to be the result or the punishment or whatever it might be. These laws, called apodictic laws, are like the Ten Commandments. Most of them just kind of state things. So just like an apodictic law is you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not commit adultery. So there's a lot of you shall not do this, you shall do this in this particular section. For instance, so say you got a guy and a girl, and she's not engaged to somebody, she's not betrothed, to use the old language. And these two are in love, as we say, and they end up having sex. What's gonna happen then? Well, if that happens, then the young man is to pay a dowry for her to be his wife. It's like the sexual act sealed the deal. That meant that they were betrothed and they were going to get married. And so the young man was forced by law then to make her his wife. He was to pay a dowry to her or to her father. All right, but what if the dad can't stand this kid? He doesn't want this. He doesn't want this guy to marry his daughter. Well, then her father, he has the authority here. Her father, if her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, gotta pay the dowry, but he can't have her for his wife. So how's that for totally ruining the romantic plans of a young couple? But that, so I guess the boy needs to either refrain until they're married, engaged and married. Or he better make sure that her dad likes him before he leads himself into temptation, because that's the situation that's laid out here.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong deterrent.
Yes, it is. It is. I don't know how often it worked, but yeah, it was a deterrent. Then You have a couple of kind of strange situations here.
Wait, are you
If
trying to
there's
tell me that God was assuming? We got in trouble here. Was God, after he gave the Ten Commandments, did God assume that the young people of Israel were going to be having sex anyway? That was going to happen?
yeah, it does appear as if that a realistic scenario.
So you're saying that like teenagers in Israel were just like teenagers everywhere else.
Yeah, they were no different. There's nothing new under the sun. There are no teenage emotions new under the sun either. Sexual drive did not all of a sudden skyrocket in the 21st century. So it's been there in full force all along. So the just kind of wrap this up. We got various laws against sorceresses and how to deal with the strangers, that is the sojourners, happen to be living in the land of Israel, to take care of them, to even if you lend money to the poor, take care of them. For instance, if you take their cloak as a pledge, give it back to them before sunset, because that's the only thing that they have to keep warm. So this is like what we talked about earlier, a concern for the vulnerable, a concern for those who have no one to look out for them. So that's the way this wraps up at the end of 22. And we'll have a little bit more to say about the Book of the Covenant next time, but it's a little different. This is dealing a lot with the sabbatical year and the three big national feasts of Israel. And then we'll have a real interesting section here at the end where we talk about an angel who bears the divine name.
Right
Turn
on.
for that good Christological discussion.
Yeah, that sounds mighty mighty Christological indeed. Well, all right. Yeah, we're out of time. So, guys, hey, remember you can use that discount code if you want to come hang out with me and Chad in San Diego. It's 40OT. Type it in the box at checkout, and you can get 10% off your tickets. We want to hang out with you, Chad. Thanks for hanging out today, man. We'll see you next week.
Bet. We'll see you then.